Welcome to this webinar. This is sponsored by the Center for Disaster Philanthropy and the Council on Foundations. We're here to talk about the response to Typhoon Haiyan, 1 month after landfall. Hi, my name is Bob Ottenhoff, and I'm the president and CEO of the Center for Disaster Philanthropy. We're joined today by a distinguished panel of individuals with rich experience across the disaster management landscape. Our discussion will include Maria Andrelita Austria, the Deputy Chief of Mission for the Embassy of the Philippines, Nate Leishman, who's the Emergency Response Manager at the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who has just returned from the Philippines, and Heidi Strassen, Director of Global Giving with Accenture, an organization that has given funds and support to the Philippines' typhoon response effort. Over the next hour, our panelists will engage in a discussion about the current status of relief efforts in the Philippines 1 month after the typhoon's landfall, how the challenges have evolved as we transition from immediate relief into rebuilding efforts, and the continued road toward recovery. We'll talk about how private philanthropy can and is responding effectively to the devastation, as well as ways that other government donors are responding. Now I'd like to turn the floor over to our partner, Andy Ho, who's here to say a few words on behalf of the Council on Foundations. Andy?
Thanks, Bob, and greetings, everyone. This is Andy Ho. I'm a network developer for global philanthropy at the Council on Foundations. And thank you very much for joining this second webinar on Typhoon Haiyan, hosted by the Center for Disaster Philanthropy and the Council on Foundations. The damage and devastation from Typhoon Haiyan continues to grow, but as many of us know, as more time passes, less assistance and aid is forthcoming as the longer-term recovery needs become the primary concern. We are pleased to partner with the Center for Disaster Philanthropy to provide our members and the larger philanthropic community with continuous, up-to-date information regarding the recovery effort in the affected areas. I'd also like to share that the Council has created a new Disaster Philanthropy Resources page on our new website with links to the Center for Disaster Philanthropy website. It has real-time information on a number of disaster response efforts nationally and internationally. You can find the page at cof.org under Initiatives and Programs and selecting Disaster Philanthropy. I'd like to thank our panelists for taking time in their busy schedules to join us today, and also thank each of you for attending this webinar and for the assistance you and your respective organizations are providing. Please do not hesitate to contact the Council team or our partners at CDP with any further questions or needs. Thank you, Bob, and I'll turn it back over to you.
All right. Thank you, Andy, and thanks to the Council on Foundations. Let's start with talking with Maria. Maria, you've got a major responsibility at the embassy. You're the Deputy Chief of Mission. So thank you so much for finding some time in your busy schedule to be with us today. Can you give us a brief status report on what things are like in the Philippines right now?
Thank you, Bob, for having us over. And thank you, too, for your initial assistance to the victims of the typhoon. As of now, based on the latest government figures, the number of fatalities have risen to close to 6,000 people. Injured is another 27,000. Missing is at 1,700. And over 3.5 million people have been displaced by what is surely among the worst catastrophes ever to hit my country. And we are grateful for the support.
So it's hard to wrap our fingers around what an amazing challenge this is to the entire country. How would you characterize the mood right now? How are people feeling? And now we're about to head into the Christmas holidays. So how would you say the people are responding to this?
Well, in numbers, just to give it a sense of perspective, in numbers, the damages brought about by the typhoon is about $570 million. So that's the magnitude. And in terms of the population, 3.5 million people displaced. This is surely one of the bleakest Christmas seasons we have faced. But the people of the Philippines have been resilient, and we are greatly strengthened by the outpouring of international support we have received.
What would you say are the biggest challenges at the moment?
While we would like to rebuild as quickly as possible, the biggest challenge for the Philippine government is to ensure that when we rebuild, we are less vulnerable to something like this. So we have to strike a balance between getting back on track as quickly as possible, but doing it in a more sustainable way.
Now, that's a subject we want to spend a lot of time on today, about resilience. And we'll get to that. I'm going to circle back and talk to you about that some more in a few minutes. On American television, we saw a lot of pictures about roads blocked and disaster relief organizations not being able to get to the affected areas. Has that pretty much been solved now? Have the logistics issues about getting goods from the airports or getting goods to some of the remote areas, has that been solved for the most part?
Well, one thing very peculiar about the Philippines is the fact that we are 7,107 islands, and a number of the small islands have also been hit. So while we see a lot of pictures of the main city, Tacloban, the challenges are twofold. Number one, clearing the roads in the main cities, especially the roads from the airports to the smaller parts of town, and getting to the other islands that have been hit. In terms of the clearing operations, we have made major progress in terms of clearing, and we are very happy to report that we are now able to reach even the smaller populations that have been hit by the typhoon.
That's good. Let's bring Nate Leishman into this discussion, and we're talking here still about the current status. What is happening today? And Nate, you're the emergency response manager at the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and you just returned from the Philippines. What were you doing while you were there, and what did you find?
The first few weeks I was there, I got there about 4 days after the typhoon hit, and it was a very difficult circumstance. One of the things that makes this a little different than some other disasters is just getting to the most affected areas was difficult those first few days and first few weeks. Getting to the Tacloban area and the other surrounding areas, getting there by air or by boat, it takes a little longer time than maybe going to Haiti, for example. And so that was a bit of a challenge. But things have improved quite a bit as far as getting around over the last month, and I think the government has done a great job. I do want to take my hat off to the many countries who provided aid, critical aid, during those first few weeks. The U.S. government and military, the Japanese, the Australians, and many other countries that came in there in a very substantial and effective way. And so I would like to express my gratitude to all of those people who helped. Right now, you know, we see several challenges. Shelters is certainly one of them. So many homes were destroyed. It's estimated that about 1.1 million homes were damaged or completely destroyed. And so it's a tremendous number, many people who are without proper shelter right now. And so certainly shelters is an issue. And other concerns, sanitation, hygiene. And the government's doing a pretty good job restoring some of the basic services of water, power, and communications, but it will still take a while longer. And we're hearing estimates that, you know, some of the most impacted areas could take up to 3 years to, you know, bring these areas back to the way they were before. One of the things that strikes me with this storm is just the vastness of it. As was stated earlier, it wasn't just the Tacloban area that was hit, even though that's what we're seeing mostly on the news. It's many, many islands, and I visited four or five islands while I was there, and just the magnitude of this. You can drive for hours, and it looks like a tornado that hit the ground that never picked up, and other areas like Tacloban, it looks like a tsunami hit the area, which basically is what happened with the storm surge. And so it's a difficult situation. The Filipino people are wonderful. I take my hats off to them. They're resilient, but it's a difficult situation they are in. And fortunately, many humanitarian organizations are responding, But being able to do this in a responsible way, you know, one of the things we noticed over there is that we could purchase any supplies we needed in the Philippines. There was really not any reason to bring in plane loads of food or things like that, because going through the right networks from Cebu or Manila, you could do that. And so oftentimes what we're seeing over there, these organizations need a financial support instead of an in-kind donation.
Nate, I'm curious about what is this the specific role of LDS. What was the area of this disaster relief that you guys were focused on? And did you have supplies on the ground before this typhoon hit?
We actually did in the Philippines. We have a large membership of our church in that area. We actually had almost 200 of our church buildings that were affected, that were impacted by this storm. At one point in the first few days of the storm, we were sheltering 15,000 people in our church buildings. And so we have a large presence there already, and we have a good network. We're used to responding in the Philippines. And so we had supply chains set up literally within days from Cebu and Manila going into the impacted areas.
Here's a question now for both Maria and for Nate. And let's start with you, Maria. What would you say are the biggest challenges at the moment?
Thank you, Bob. I would like to break that in three big areas. The first is the cost of relief. The first is relief. The second will be housing. And the third will be livelihood. So these are the things that we would like to focus on.
Give me a little bit more detail about each one of those points.
As of now, as Nate mentioned, a number of our people are still living. They've not gone back to normal. They are either homeless. They are definitely displaced, either living in evacuation centers or living in houses which are not really safe. They have no means of livelihood. They have no food. So we are still, distribution of food is still ongoing. So that's the immediate cost, getting people cured.
So when I saw you last, you were saying that there were still some people who had not even made it into temporary shelters. Would you say that issue has been resolved now? Does everyone have a place to stay?
We currently still have about 21,000 families in over 380 evacuation centers in the devastated area. So that has not been totally resolved.
Yeah. So that was point number one.
Point number one was immediate relief. Point number two is getting them back to their houses, which also has a big environmental study component going on. And the third is restoring their livelihood.
Right.
So those three.
Right. Nate, what would you say? What are the biggest challenges at the moment?
I would agree exactly with Maria on all of those. Not only did people lose their homes, but they lost their means to support themselves with this typhoon, destroying businesses and agriculture. And so livelihood projects like supporting the fishing industry, agricultural projects, other things like that is going to be critical, not just for the next few months, but really for the next few years, and helping to rebuild industries over there. You see the coconut tree industry just wiped out, which is a big source of income for some of those islands that were affected, and the fishing industry. And so in getting people back into a proper home, a proper shelter is important. One of the things that I witnessed over there is that many people are rebuilding already, taking scraps of wood, scraps of tin, throwing up temporary shelters, whatever they can, to keep their home, their property. And so they, you know, some people are afraid that they're going to lose that if they leave. And so people are afraid to leave because that is their home, and they don't want, you know, a bulldozer to come in and just demolish what was left. So there's some anxiety and fear amongst the people there, and it's really just a sense of unsureness on what's going to happen next and where help's going to come from.
I'm going to bring in Heidi Strassen at this point. Heidi's calling in today from the United Kingdom, and she's the director of Global Giving with Accenture, which is an organization that has given funds and supported the Philippines typhoon response effort. Heidi, thank you so much for being on the call with us today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to join you.
As you know, Heidi, we've got many donors on the phone today who have either made a gift or are still considering what role they should play. So maybe you could start by telling us a little bit about the role you have at Accenture, and then tell us a little bit about why did Accenture decide to devote funds to this typhoon response?
Sure. So my role at Accenture is to look after some of our more high-value strategic and global partnerships under a program that we call Skills to Succeed, which is where we've made a corporate citizenship commitment to equipping 500,000 people around the world with the skills to get a job or build a business by 2015. And within that program, I'm also responsible for informing Accenture's response to disasters as they occur, and particularly of the nature and magnitude of the one we're describing here. And our interest here, we've got a large business presence in the Philippines. I think we've got something like 275,000 people serving clients around the world in about 120 countries. But our presence in the Philippines is a growing one, and it's a very vibrant market. The people who work for Accenture in that country are extremely committed, engaged, mostly young individuals. When we saw the nature of the impact, unfortunately not for the first time in that country, and we saw the extent of devastation, our first interest always is to ensure and understand the actual direct impact and welfare of Accenture people. But beyond that, we wanted to make sure that we were making a lasting commitment towards community relief and rehabilitation. And for us, that is in this space of livelihood that Nate and Maria just started to describe. So it was a very natural response to us to want to show our corporate responsibility and compassion, I think, for what was happening in that country. But given that we'll have a long-standing presence in the market, we want to show our support over the years ahead and to create a lasting, what we hope will be a lasting contribution.
Describe a little bit about the nature of your contributions to the typhoon response.
In the first few days after the typhoon occurred, we mobilized employee giving so that people around the Accenture family around the world could donate. And we channeled that for the most part to the Red Cross, to the campaign in support of the Philippine Red Cross. We've raised just over 600,000 to date through that channel. But we immediately reached out to various of our more strategic partners who have a presence in the Philippines to understand ways in which we might be able to support their efforts a little bit down the track. We've made a $1 million commitment to Plan International. The cash grant that we're committing will support long-term reconstruction and rehabilitation efforts. And our emphasis will be around enabling communities to rebuild through skills development and economic activity. Some of the things that Nate started to mention just now could well feature in that. But we've made a commitment within that million to deliver pro bono support to Plan International in the Philippines to help them during the reconstruction phase really think about how they might be able to drive full value from the cash support that they're getting from others and from others, so that they can be in the best possible place to build a rehabilitation and reconstruction response that's going to be meeting local needs and putting them in good stead, picking up on Maria's point about building resilience, working with local government and agencies to make sure that they're really equipped to drive a sustainable impact.
Here at the center, we frequently get phone calls from donors who want to do something but aren't always sure about what to do. They don't want to make a mistake. They also don't know when to respond. And so I wonder if you could share with us a little bit about the process you went through at Accenture in making this gift. Do you have a committee? Do you have a disaster response team? What's the process you go through, and why do you decide to select support for some disasters when there are so many disasters taking place around the world all the time?
I think it's very important to have a prepared position, a clear strategy that defines some of the parameters and the decision makers, and to have a governance model and a way of basically fast-tracking decisions when you need to. Our strategy is to commit to the reconstruction efforts that align with our wider, what we call skills to succeed interests. And we also have a strategy that means that we will turn first and foremost to our existed trusting partners. We can have a very honest dialogue with them in the aftermath of a situation, subject to their availability and to their understanding the context. But the nature of our partnerships mean that we're prepared to commit up front and then trust to work together with our local partnerships, with our local representatives to work out the detail afterwards. And I think you only get that when you've worked together and have got some history and some understanding and some shared delivery. But for sure, we've got some internal mechanisms that greatly advantage being able to make decisions swiftly. Our committee can convene electronically over email, can be on point within hours, and can be making decisions that we can then escalate to investment commitments. We work across various parts of our business, making sure we're connecting with all the right bits, which we've identified in advance, so everybody knows who they need to be connecting with to make sure that we're all joined up and that we're making an appropriate response. Ours in the corporate citizenship space tends to come after some important decisions and after some important understanding is established regarding employee welfare. So, I mean, I think for us, there's a kind of critical path of information that's needed. But once we're equipped with what we need to know, we can work very swiftly towards reaching a decision. But in terms of the magnitude of disaster that triggers it, having a local presence, having a business interest, having people who work for us who were directly impacted is always going to trigger the attention in the global arena for Accenture. Having a long-standing business and an interest in staying in the territory is also a motivation to us. But we are also very moved by the response from Accenture people around the world. We get notification from all quarters, which escalates to us the level of employee interest that we're hearing, and we listen to that. So we're very much informed and moved by the response that we hear from our own people.
Thank you. Very interesting. I just want to remind our listeners that you can submit a question at any time using either the Q&A or the chat box on the right-hand side of your screen. Simply select host from the drop-down list, type your question, and hit send. And if you prefer to ask your question vocally, click the hand icon on your participant's box and wait until called upon. Maria, I want to go back to you for a moment. And we just heard from Accenture and from Heidi Strawson about what one large corporation was motivated to do and the process they went through. We've been hearing a lot that the Filipino-American community has been active. Could you tell us some of the things that have been going on?
Thank you, Bob. We've been, as like our the support from the international community, the Filipino-American community has come in great force. They've weighed in very heavily on the rescue efforts with programs ranging from benefit concerts to fundraisers, and they have been very vocal in requesting the U.S. government, also their local legislators, for support for the Philippines. And we're very grateful.
If someone wanted to learn more about what the Filipino community is doing here in the United States, are there some places where we could go or call or learn more?
The Philippine Embassy has a tab on its website called the Bayanihan, which more or less provides information on what the Filipino-American community has been doing.
I mean, I think probably everybody in this room and probably on the phone has friends who were either came from the Philippines or have family in the Philippines. And just how large is the Filipino-American community?
3.4 million all over the U.S.
That's a lot.
Yes, that's a lot.
That's a lot. So I wonder if we could turn our discussion now to this issue about the appropriate way to rebuild. Maria, you mentioned a minute ago the Philippines consists of 7,100 islands. So by definition, most citizens either live along the coastline or near a coastline. And that is, as we know, as seawater rises and cyclones happen more frequently, makes them very vulnerable. So tell us a little bit about how the government is thinking about the rebuilding process, and how do you go about building communities that are more resilient?
Just to magnify the point that you made about us living on the coast, we are practically just about the size of Arizona in terms of landmass, but we have twice the length of coastline that the U.S. does because of the fact that we are an archipelago. So as you said, most everyone lives on coastline. So the dilemma now is whether to allow people to rebuild back where they used to be, but or provide some look at building a seawall or a setback where we will move people back from the coastline. But it will be a very major undertaking, and a lot of studies require. But the idea is to build back better. And basically to make sure that we are able to reduce our vulnerabilities to climate change, to natural disasters, and also strengthen our national capacity to cope with future incidents.
So is the government going to engage in some kind of a process that involves citizens? How are they going to make these decisions?
The president has created a cabinet cluster committee, a task force within the cabinet to look at all these things. And by next week, we will be launching our Yolanda Recovery and Reconstruction Plan. This will be launched by a group of cabinet officials, the Department of Foreign Affairs, the Department of Finance, and the Socioeconomic Planning Secretary will be hosting a session with our donor partners. And we will lay out the broad framework of what we see as our recovery and reconstruction plan.
I think I saw a statistic a little while ago that there's been over 20 cyclones this year alone that have hit the Philippines. So natural disasters are now a way of life.
Yes.
And so as this discussion about rebuilding, building resilient communities, has that been going on for a while, or is this now something new?
It has been. We have living in that area, we have been particularly vulnerable. Our neighbors have not been spared, Aceh, Thailand. So we are working very hard. This has been an ongoing discussion, but the magnitude of this disaster has underscored the importance of doing this sooner rather than later.
We had a question from one of our listeners who wanted to know the total number of islands that were affected by Haiyan.
I'm afraid I don't have that number, but in terms of magnitude, the affected area covered about 5,000 kilometers. So, and there are many small islands within that area.
I want to bring Nate and Heidi into this conversation. And let's start with you, Nate, since you just returned from the Philippines. When you think about rebuilding and recovery and building more resilient communities, so what does that mean to you, having just come back from the Philippines? Do you have some opinions about what the Philippines can do to build more resilient communities?
I do, and this is always one of the difficult things because it starts at so many levels. First of all, building proper infrastructure, the power grid, the water systems, things like that. And so there's a level of the government that they certainly need to take a look at and do the best job they can at building back better. As has been mentioned, the Philippines has many typhoons every year, on an average about 20 per year. And so typhoons are not a new thing to them, but being able to deal with typhoons of a bigger nature is important. And so starting with at the government level and then going down to neighborhoods, having a plan and having stricter codes. And that's sometimes hard to do in a developing country or country that don't have quite as many resources as other countries. And helping residents who are building their own homes to have some kind of basic standards, because many people that were impacted and affected by this storm live in very simple structures. It's as simple as, you know, four posts and some bamboo or a coconut tree wood with some tin on the roof. And so certainly you see homes, the homes that survived over there, there are homes that are made of concrete or cinder block, they actually held up fairly well. Yes, they lost some roofing and some other things like that, but setting some minimum standards, and it's a difficult challenge in a location like that, but I think you've got to start somewhere. And so I fully believe in building back better. That's a term that we're hearing often right now, is taking the time. You know, a lot of groups want to jump right in now. We're seeing a lot of humanitarian groups wanting to jump in and start the rebuilding process now. Others are saying, wait, hold on, we need to do this in an organized fashion. And so OCHA is doing a great job of directing some of that work in the shelter plan, and some of the other large humanitarian organizations are also saying, let's do this right, let's take some time and do the planning. In the meantime, you still got people who need shelter, but I think it's the right approach to do this in an organized way, do it in cooperation with the local government at the city level, and also the national government of the Philippines.
Heidi, you also mentioned resilience in some of the thinking you had at Accenture about this. Could you talk a little bit about that? What are you folks thinking about when the subject of rebuilding, recovery, resilience comes up? And what do you plan to be engaged in?
We are aware that the things Nate described, that kind of hierarchy from the macro down, is required. You need that infrastructure, you need resilience at all those levels, but I think we're looking to take it down to the community, even to the individual level, building resilience amongst people at the skill level to manage and help them maximize their own potential, such that certainly they can rebuild and secure their own economic potential and livelihoods in the aftermath, but potentially perhaps do so again and again to understand some of their strengths. It would vary from an urban context through to rural, perhaps, but examples might include working in the agricultural space, for example, helping people with pretty basic financial literacy, but the skills to help them understand farming as a business, so that if one crop fails and you lose everything, you're able to perhaps understand how to work collaboratively with others, how to hold back certain proportions of your seeds in order to carry you over, how to maybe understand a little bit about your local supply chain and value chain to be able to maximize your potential to make a small profit and return. Now, of course, you can only do those things when certain startup costs have been covered and when certain infrastructure is present. But I think when we look at what some of our partners are doing, we're looking at building their capacity to invest in those sorts of skill-building programs, helping them understand the market context and the sorts of skills that are going to be most appropriate for communities to stand back on their own two feet in terms of the local economics. And we know that there are various ways of doing that, and we trust to the expertise of our partners who are well-versed in the communities that they serve, might be quite specific, tailored solutions on a case-by-case basis.
Thank you, Maria. This is a question that just came in from one of our listeners. What, if anything, is being done about rebuilding schools? Are children, in fact, getting back to school, or is it too soon to even think about this?
We have a special, within the task force that I mentioned earlier, there's a special cluster devoted exclusively to making sure that children are able to go back to school at the soonest possible time. Some schools have resumed operations, but unfortunately, we have not done that for all.
And a follow-up question for you, Maria, and also for Nate. Can donors assume that the emergency relief efforts have now been met for the most part? So if they wanted to make a donation, can they assume that disaster relief, things like tents and food and other things, those needs have now been met?
On the part of the Philippine government, Nate's point was right that after the initial influx, most of the things are available in Manila and Cebu, especially food, temporary shelter. What we are really focusing now is the medium-term and long-term efforts.
Nate, would you like to add to that briefly?
I would agree, but I think there's still certain areas that need emergency relief assistance with food, water, shelter, and things like that. And that will probably be the case for a few more months to come. Yes, the supply lines have improved, but there are many stores that are shut down because of this, especially in the Tacloban area. Tacloban is the hub for the islands of Samar and Leyte, and their distribution lines have greatly been disrupted. And so it's parts of this are still in the emergency response phase, even though the recovery phase has started. There will be a need to assist for months, if not years to come.
Let's move on then to what donors should be thinking about. And this is a question for all three of you. We've now heard a little bit about what's going on and the immediate needs. But if you're a donor who hasn't done something yet, where would you suggest that they focus their attention? And Heidi, let's start with you.
I think to make a lasting impact, to be able to have a sense of being able to measure the value of what you've done, it would make some sense to commit to any existing partnership that you might have, of course, assuming that that partnership were a positive one. I think for our part, I can't recommend what might work for others, but we have quite clear parameters that guide our giving generally, and we try, to whatever extent is appropriate, to align those in a post-disaster relief situation so that we can remain kind of on mission. That allows us to fall back on some of our existing processes and ways of measuring and supporting and working with our partners. So I think to whatever extent you can fall back on anything you've already got, that's great. But in the absence of that, there are some very trusted organizations with a proven record of delivery, and anyone who's unsure of whom to give towards could possibly consider some of the more well-known and trust that they are adept and experienced in driving good value from any funds that we might donate. We tend to do a little bit of a mixture of both, I guess. But the benefit of the former approach is that you could have a structured giving deal that's explicit in its scope and invites you both to re-qualify and address and maybe redirect the course over the duration of the term.
Nate, how about yourself? What would you say in terms of advice to a donor who may still be thinking about a contribution? What kinds of activities should they be focusing on at this point?
Well, I agree with everything Heidi has said. Some great advice. I would say do your homework. And again, if you've worked with organizations that you trust and you know they're there and are, you know, doing work, that's obviously might be a clear choice for you. There are literally hundreds of response organizations, NGOs, who are over there now or who will be over there in the next several months assisting. And so there's many options to give. But again, do your homework. Some of the bigger organizations that have good reputations are a good choice. One of the things I've learned in this work is maybe having a rifle approach instead of a shotgun approach. And sometimes, you know, groups will give a little bit of money to many, many organizations. And again, every dollar helps. I don't want to discourage giving, but sometimes you could focus on one community or one project. It could be a water project. It could be a livelihood project. And having a greater donation to one specific project may make a bigger impact for a community or for a group of people. And so that's one of the things I've learned over the years is sometimes taking a narrower approach, you can have a greater impact.
Maria, what would your advice be to donors out there who have not made a contribution yet? What area would you recommend that they focus their activities on at this point?
Both Nate and Heidi made very good points, but from a broader perspective, I'd like to identify some broader areas that we're looking at, like shelter and reconstruction, power restoration, livelihood and employment, resettlement and counseling, education and environmental protection. Those are the broad elements that will be included in the plan that we will roll out.
I should also mention here that the center has been asked by donors to help them with collaborating, and so we've created a fund that's going to be focused on medium and long-term rebuilding. We don't know where that will go. It'll depend on discussions with NGOs and with local and federal governments. But we're going to focus on needs like vulnerable populations, meeting them, long-term recovery efforts, and filling in some of those much-needed gaps that we've been talking about. We've got some more questions from listeners, and let's start with you, Marie, on this one. What is the role of grassroots and local organizations in building resiliency, and are funds reaching local NGOs?
During the earlier days of the tragedy, that was the biggest difficulty we had, making sure that funds reached the most vulnerable of populations. And the local NGOs have been marvelous in making sure that attention is given to those that have not been noticed initially because of the magnitude of the problem. We continue to work with local NGOs, specifically our Department of Social Welfare and Development, who is headed by a woman who spent much of her professional career among the NGOs, is very much in touch with the NGOs, and we are constantly soliciting their feedback and their inputs and working closely with them.
Another question, how best can financial assistance be given to individual specific families affected by the typhoon? And is this something you would recommend? And Marie, let's start with you and then ask the other panelists to comment on that.
Considering that there are so many close family and personal ties between the Philippines and the U.S., a number of channels have been opened for direct remittance to specific individuals or families. Like Western Union has been very helpful. For a while, they were offering free, they were waiving their remittance fees to get to the most affected areas. And most, a lot of the financial services have been back up. So there are now the usual the normal mechanisms for doing that have been reactivated.
Heidi or Nate, would you like to comment on that? Financial assistance to individual families.
That's an interesting question. We've received many phone calls from people who have friends or relatives in the Philippines wanting to help them. And certainly helping family members, I think, is a good thing. One needs to be careful just sending a donation to an individual family if they don't know the circumstances. You hate to say this, but there are unscrupulous people out there sometimes that take advantage of these types of situations. And I don't want to accuse anybody of doing that, but doing things in a fair and equitable way, especially if it's a larger donation, I would still encourage people to consider going through an established organization. And speaking of local Filipino NGOs, we found some wonderful, wonderful Filipino organizations doing great work. Sometimes all they lack is a little bit of capital to do things in a better and more effective way. So looking for some of the international groups who are partnering with the local Filipino organizations, I think, is very healthy, and it's a great thing that we encourage.
Heidi, would you like to add anything to that?
All I would add is that to get it right takes a lot of time and effort to be transparent, fair, equitable, to be able to fully understand needs and address them appropriately within whatever limited resources are available is a demanding exercise. And we have some limited experience of doing this, and it's not something we undertook lightly. The effort is most certainly worth it if you can be assured those resources are going to get to people in need. But I just wouldn't underestimate the amount of effort required. And if there is an organization on the ground, such as I think you're describing, Nate, that can administer and help manage that process in a way that's just and attributable, then that would be an interesting option to explore rather than imagining that you could administer it yourself.
So I want to ask a question about the media. We know that disaster giving follows media coverage of a disaster. And so the normal rule of thumb we have here at the center is 90% of the money will come in within 90 days after a disaster. It's been a little disturbing to see how little American media coverage there's been of the disaster in the last, few weeks. It's very hard to get updates, even in some of our large daily newspapers. Why do you think that is, Maria? And what is being done about that, or what can be done about it?
Well, while we made the front pages of the Washington Post for like 3 days consecutively immediately after the disaster, you're right, Bob, that in recent weeks, the U.S. media has hardly paid any attention, though the magnitude of the problem remains. We remain in close coordination at the government level, and it's also very helpful that media personalities are continuing to pay interest, like Justin Bieber was in Manila a few days ago. And that was great in terms of the additional publicity, not just in terms of what he did, but also the additional publicity it generated. So we're hopeful that through the efforts of those who want to help, the media will continue to pay attention.
And then this question to all three panelists. One of our goals in these webinars and at the center is to improve the effectiveness and impact of disaster philanthropy. So without naming names or naming specific projects, are there areas where we think we could improve the effectiveness of disaster philanthropy? Are there areas where perhaps we could have done things differently in this one, or ones where we could begin to think about doing things differently in the future? And let's start with you, Nate, and then go to Heidi, and then follow up with Maria.
That's a really interesting question. I don't know if anybody's ever asked me that question before, but as I consider that, certainly, as Maria has mentioned, tapping into the international giving community right up at the front is it's effective, you know, partly because it's people's our emotions are connected to what they're seeing on TV. And it, sadly, with so many other, like so many other disasters, once the news media has stopped, once it's slowed down, people forget about things, they go on with their lives, and even new disasters crop up, and humanitarian organizations even turn to that. And so finding ways to, again, extend that interest beyond those first few weeks is important. And so, and that's a difficult challenge. But as we're just learning now, you know, some of the immediate needs have been taken care of. The greater needs lie ahead within the next year. And that's where, you know, the real funding of making a difference, of helping to rebuild lives, helping to get people back to work, helping to build a resilient community, that work takes place now. And unfortunately, people have already moved on with their lives or with different events. And so having the ability to keep getting the word out, I think, is something we can all do a little bit better.
Heidi, what's your perspective on this?
We've worked in Haiti, in various places, actually, Banda Aceh, various instances in the Philippines, where we've been able to engage with various of our nonprofit partners, with government agencies, with donors, trying to understand what the long-term benefits are, how you measure them. And I think oftentimes, and coming with a background as we do in global management consulting and technology services, we see a lot of opportunities to connect dots and make drive certain efficiencies between a number of disparate players who have different drivers, different ways of measuring success. I think there's invariably a case to have better technology enablement, to be aligning core processes, to have monitoring and evaluation systems that feed in and inform overarching ways of measuring the status of play and so on. So I think we've got some particular insights and interests in those sorts of disciplines, but otherwise I would agree with previous comments, I guess.
Thank you. And Maria, are there ways you wish the donor community would have responded differently, or can you think about ways that you'd like to see things change going forward from here?
Well, thank you, Bob. I'd like to believe the best is yet to come. The experience in the Philippines, the devastation is just so massive that in some areas, it's like we're starting over. So I believe it will be a good opportunity for disaster philanthropy to focus on the rebuilding part. We are practically building new communities, better, more resilient communities, and we hope this is something that will be of interest to the philanthropic community.
Our time is just about up, and I want to ask each of our panelists to end with just a few seconds in summary and to give us some advice as we and I want these comments to be directed at the donor community. So as the donors begin to think about next year and still think about what they might do in the Philippines, what would be your advice about what they should do for the Philippines now if they haven't done something already? And what should they be thinking about disaster philanthropy in general as they make their plans for 2014? And we'll use the same order again. We'll start with Nate and Heidi, and then we'll ask Maria to sum it up for us.
I would conclude my remarks today by saying, first of all, the Filipino people are amazing people. They've been hit with a devastating storm that affected so many people, but I have the greatest respect for their resiliency. You've never seen a smile like a Filipino smile. Those smiles are forever ingrained in my mind, even in the most difficult of circumstances. There's a great need out there. There's wonderful organizations, many international organizations, many local organizations. Take some time, do a little bit of homework, reach out to some trusted partners that you may have established already, and maybe pick a specific area in which you could help. The need is great. Groups are going to be assisting for months, if not years, to come, and so I encourage you to look at some longer-term projects that will really help these people to get back up on their feet again and help this area become a vibrant and more resilient area. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Heidi?
I think you passed the baton to me, Bob. I would say that even if the media are packing up and going home, there is an opportunity to make contributions towards the longer-term reconstruction of those communities devastated, and the investments are going to make a lasting difference to communities who will really need it. So I would urge anyone who's considering giving but haven't yet done so to consider ways to manifest that. But in terms of looking ahead and what we might do differently, I suppose just be prepared now for the next time so that you have in place a set of processes and procedures that you can act upon swiftly, understand your trigger points, and know how you will mobilize in order to make appropriate decisions. But I think also be aware that the right decision isn't always the decision that needs to be made in the most emotional sort of immediacy of the moment. Be aware that sometimes it takes time on the ground and with careful consideration and awareness to formulate the right approach, and there's no shame in that. That can be part of a very meaningful, longer-term, sustainable contribution.
On behalf of the Filipino people, we'd like to express our sincere gratitude and appreciation for the immediate assistance, which have been critical in getting us to where we are now. However, I'd also like to make a point that rebuilding is equally critical. By next week, we are launching our recovery plan, which we will be happy to share with everyone. And I hope that for while you make your plans for 2014, you will continue to find ways to extend the assistance as we will outline in the recovery plan that we will launch soon.
Thank you. Well, I want to say thank you to our three guests, Maria Andralita Austria, who's the Deputy Chief of Mission for the Embassy of the Philippines, Nate Leishman, who's the Emergency Response Manager for the LDS Church, Heidi Strawson, who's the Director of Global Giving with Accenture, calling in from the UK today. If we haven't been able to answer your questions yet, or if you've got some questions about our CDP fund, or you can certainly call our hotline, which is 206-972-0187, or go to our website, disasterphilanthropy.org. A special thanks as well to the Council on Foundations for co-hosting this webinar. And thank you to everyone who joined us today for this webinar. Thank you.